Welcome to My Favorite Mystic, a podcast about the weird and wonderful world of mysticism. I'm AJ Langley, and today I'm joined by Barbara Newman. She is John Evans Professor of Latin and Professor of English Classics and History at Northwestern University, and she's known for her work on medieval religious culture, comparative literature, and women's spirituality. Barbara, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure, Amanda.
Now, today you're here to talk about Charles Williams, potentially someone unexpected for those who know about all of your work.
That's right. I figure all of the medieval mystics are already taken. So I could talk about Julian of Norwich, or I could talk about Hildegard of Bingen, but other people have already done them and just about all the medievals. So why not a 20th century figure?
Absolutely. And we are short of people to talk about the 20th century. However, as I've said many times, I'm very happy to have double ups on our medieval mystics. I think we all talk about them differently. And, you know, who can get enough of Hildegard of Bingen, really, when we drill right down into it? Before we get into Charles Williams, let's talk about you. You've written so much, you've done so much work in this area, but how did you find yourself studying mysticism? How did you become an academic in this area?
Oh dear, that's a hard question. I've always been interested in religion, mysticism, spirituality. I mean, I spent much of my college career, I double majored in religion and English, and I've always done interdisciplinary work on literature and religion. I would ask, why isn't everyone a medievalist? Why isn't everyone interested in mysticism? It's just so fascinating. I don't have a particular aha moment when I suddenly became interested in it.
Absolutely. I mean, I always find it really hard to justify to other people why I study what I study and why mysticism is interesting, because the idea that other people might not be interested is the part that I find really weird.
Right. I agree.
Did you have a gateway mystic? Was there a particular person that you read and said, no, I need to figure out more about what's happening with these mystics?
Julian of Norwich was one of the first that I read. The Cloud of Unknowing was another.
So very traditional English entry into the space of mysticism.
Yeah. Also, the Victorines. I studied with Grover Zinn in college, and he was an expert on the Victorines. So I read Hugh and Richard of St. Victor as a college junior. That was probably unusual.
Yeah, I don't think people get an early introduction to the Victorines. But today we are talking about Charles Williams. We are moving into the 20th century, where we don't have quite as many mystics, and where those that we do have seem to come with a lot more caveats of their poets and writers and occultists. There's a lot of other words that end up coming along with them. And then we kind of maybe throw mystic in there. So can you tell me, before we get into his biography, how did you first come across Charles Williams? Is this part of your larger work with mystics and spirituality, or was he a pure accident?
I probably encountered him in the same way that most people do, which is through C.S. Lewis. I read scads of C.S. Lewis when I was still a college student at Oberlin, and C.S. Lewis founded a small literary club at Oxford. J.R.R. Tolkien was a member of it, various other philosophers and friends of his, but also Charles Williams, who was a great friend of Lewis. And Williams tends to be known to a lot of people now as the Third Inkling. That's even the title of his biography by Greville Lindup, but he's much more than that. And he's actually very, very different from Lewis, let alone Tolkien, even though they were all friends. So when I was reading around C.S. Lewis, I started reading Williams, and I thought, whoa, this guy is amazing.
Well, anything that makes you go, whoa, I think is going to be beyond worthy of talking about. So let's talk about how he's so different. What do we know about Charles Williams, his biography? Who is this man?
Yeah, he was English. He was a Londoner, born 1886, died in 1945, just after the armistice was signed to end World War II. And unlike C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, He was raised in poverty. He was always a champion of the working man. And tragically, although he was a brilliant intellectual, he started studying at the University College London and had to drop out for lack of funds, just couldn't afford the tuition. So he got a very entry-level job as a proofreader at Oxford University Press. And his skills clearly went beyond proofreading. And within a very short time, he had risen to an editorial post and became the major poetry editor for the press and took on lots and lots of projects and worked for Oxford University Press to his dying day. That was always his day job. And as a publisher, he was responsible for some amazing things like the first English translation of Søren Kierkegaard, the Letters of Evelyn Underhill, the first edition of Gerard Manley Hopkins, maybe it was the second edition. And he also helped to publicize Julian of Norwich. It's through Williams that T.S. Eliot became acquainted with Julian of Norwich and introduced All Manner of Things Shall Be Well into Little Guinea. But that was just his day job. On the side, he wrote and wrote and wrote endlessly. He always considered himself primarily a poet, published many, many volumes of poetry. The best is his late work, his Arthurian cycle, Taliesin through Logris and the Region of the Summer Stars. He had many more unfinished poems when he died. He's probably best known as a novelist for his 7 published novels. T.S. Eliot called them supernatural thrillers, which is a perfectly good name for them. In addition, he wrote plays. He wrote theology as a layman. He wrote literary criticism, particularly of Dante. He wrote biographies. So he was just an incredibly versatile writer and a mystic on the side.
I love the idea of, you know, his day job was being a publisher, his side gig was being a writer himself, and then on top of that, he's a mystic, just stacking jobs on jobs on jobs. He was gig economy before it was cool. So when we talk about him being a mystic, obviously that is a fraught term when you start trying to define it. When you say that he's a mystic, what does that mean in his context? What did that look like? What do we know about that with regards to his situation?
That's a really good question. It means a lot of different things. He was, first of all, a staunch member of the Church of England. He belonged to the Anglo-Catholic wing of the church and, you know, was always at Mass. And he had a very liturgical spirituality. He had, far more than most people, a profound sense of ritual and ceremony. But in his case, ritual and ceremony went beyond the Church of England because he also practiced ritual magic. He was a member of the Rosicrucians, a kind of offshoot of the famous Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And for about 7 to 10 years, he was very actively involved in ritual magic. He went through many grades of initiation. He helped to initiate others. And you can find in his novels this confluence of interests in Orthodox Christianity. His theology was Orthodox, though unconventional, one might say, and churchmanship and the occult. And he depicted occultism in both favorable and unfavorable lights. Many of his villains are dark magicians. Then, in addition, there was his very distinctive theological insight into what he called coherence. And here is where his Christian mysticism really begins. Coherence is a fairly little known theological term that's really a theory of personhood. I think it should be better known. My most recent book, The Permeable Self, 5 Medieval Relationships, is all about coherence. It is, one could say, an explanation of the most mysterious word in the New Testament, which is the preposition in. What does it mean when Jesus in John's Gospel says, "I am in the Father and the Father is in me. Abide in me as I abide in you. He prays for his disciples that they all may be one as we are one, you know, I in them and they in you, Father, and so forth. And St. Paul also speaks about this. He talks about being members of Christ and how all Christians are in Christ, members of Christ. So in return, we are members of one another. So coherence is the term used for this mutual indwelling, for one person having his or her being in the person of another. You can say that the three persons of the Trinity have coherence. You can say that the divine and the human natures of Christ have coherence. They dwell within one another. You can say that as Jesus dwells in Mary, the God-bearer, in her womb, so she also dwells in him, in the mind of God. And William's great insight was that coherence is a way of living in human community in the world, and it can be practiced intentionally so that we emphasize, we dwell on this very profound form of interconnectedness through what he calls substituted love. That's his way of looking at the atonement or the sacrifice of Jesus, that Jesus substitutes his love for the love that is owed by humankind. And he was also very keen, St. Paul's suggestion or command, that we bear one another's burdens. And this was his particular mystical practice. And he teaches this mainly in his novels. There are all kinds of scenes of mystical and contemplative prayer in the novels, and they have to do with this technique. Suppose that you have to do something which is very frightening for you. Suppose you are going on a long flight and you're terrified of planes. I or any friend of yours could say, let me bear that fear for you, so that when you fly, you can simply enjoy the flight. I don't know if anyone ever enjoys a flight, but imagine that that's possible. And I would then perform a kind of exercise of imagination in a state of prayer where I imagine you boarding that plane and being terrified, and I take that terror on myself. I don't necessarily feel it as intensely as you would feel it, but I make an act of will. I make that act of will in God to carry that fear for you. You can also carry pain. You can carry grief, anxiety, you know, any negative emotion that might stop someone from doing what it is that they have to do or are called to do. And that's the practice of bearing one another's burdens, which William says is possible because we all exist in a state of coherence with one another and with God. And so that's the primary aspect, I would say, of William's mysticism.
I really love this idea of substituted love, and it's something that I think we see with medieval mystics as well. Not even just substitutive, but like supplementary. You know, if you can't suffer enough or your suffering doesn't earn you enough grace, then you can dip into the pool of grace that Christ has achieved for humanity through all of his suffering. It really does echo this earlier period.
It's a very medieval idea, and Williams even says somewhere that the principle is one of the open secrets of the saints, and we might draw one step nearer to sanctity if we used it.
Okay, climbing that ladder, I like it. When he's talking about this idea of bearing other people's burdens, does he describe how one goes about that? Is it not necessarily pastoral, but like teaching practice that we find either in these novels or in other writings of how to perform this? Or is there no specific way? It's just something that you should just be able to do.
Yeah, he gives a lot of specific examples. There's in his novel, Descent into Hell, there's the character of the playwright Stanhope, who's kind of an idealized version of Williams himself, who practices and teaches this. In the novel, The Greater Trumps, which is one of my favorites, there's a maiden lady named Sybil who's a very saintly figure, and she also practices it and teaches it. And his genius lies partly in creating in these novels, which are set in the real world, they're all set in contemporary London, but they're also set in a supernatural world that impinges very closely and directly, that coheres with the world that we live in. And so angels and demons and Platonic archetypes and all forms of magic, the Holy Grail, the Stone of Suleiman, all these things materialize not in some kind of magical other world, but in this world, and in showing how his characters deal with these situations, he also tries to teach his readers how to do the practice.
Okay, I can definitely see the supernatural part of supernatural thrillers. Were they thrillers in the modern sense of the term? Is there some sort of crime being solved alongside of this? Or what made them thrilling, these novels?
The plots are so fast moving and so strange. Some of them are murder mysteries. Some of them are about villains, often dark magicians, who have either committed crimes or they're plotting how to commit crimes, and the good characters have to try to forestall that and prevent the crime. In War in Heaven, which is his Grail romance, the Holy Grail is discovered to be the ordinary chalice at this sleepy little parish in rural England, where fortunately the parish priest happens to be a saint, although nobody knows this.
I mean, it's very convenient.
It's very convenient. And so the evil magicians try to steal it, and do steal it at one point, to use it for rituals of black magic, you know, to perform satanic rites with it. And this humble priest and a skeptical journalist and a romantic duke form an unlikely fellowship to try to foil the dark magicians and save the Grail. And eventually they succeed. But, you know, there is a murder. I think there's more than one murder. And often the plots thicken toward some very, very melodramatic climax. So yeah, they are thrillers.
These sound fantastic. I love this unlikely band of a devout priest and a skeptic and this romantic duke. That's amazing. They're all coming together to save the Holy Grail. And how little has the concept of black magic and witchcraft changed between the late medieval and the 20th century, if it's still, we're going to steal this holy item and desecrate it for our dark magic? The pathway there is so clear.
Yeah, it is. Certainly, dark magic goes way, way back through the Middle Ages to antiquity. It enjoyed, if that's the right word, a particular revival in the late 19th and early 20th century. I mean, even someone like Evelyn Underhill, whom we think of as this sort of unimpeachable spiritual leader, wrote early novels about the occult before she got into leading retreats and writing about worship and mysticism. So it was very much in vogue. And so Williams was writing in a genre that people were reading, but he gave it very much his own spin.
Absolutely. And for those who have listened to previous episodes, on episode 7, we had Jane Shaw talking about Evelyn Underhill. And on episode 15, we had Georgia von Ralta talking about Dion Fortune. So we've got two of Williams's contemporaries who are also, you know, writing these novels, engaging with these ideas, putting them into fictional works in order to spread these ideas further. So we often find our mystics getting into a little bit of trouble, either in their lives or having controversy that follows them afterwards. Was Charles Williams in any way a controversial figure?
There has been controversy, not during his lifetime, but in recent decades, as more has come out about his practice of ritual magic. And there is a dark side to it. He formed a kind of lay religious order called the Companions of the Coherence, who made it their mission to live and teach and practice coherence. Williams himself was kind of the unofficial head of it. It was never an officially approved religious order of the Church of England, but I think it aspired to that status. He didn't live long enough to pursue it. But he also continued to perform magical rituals with his female disciples, sometimes against their will. He was tremendously charismatic. There are records, T.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, of course, W.H. Auden, many of the leading figures of the day, literary figures who knew Williams just couldn't say enough about his saintliness and his charisma. But that charisma allowed him to attract especially many young women as disciples. He would give these public lectures in, you know, City of London, classes for the working public. This was a London thing in the mid-20th century. And some of these women, you know, were very intelligent women who became authors in their own right, but they were also kind of groupies. I mean, whenever Williams gave a talk, they wanted to be there. And he would sometimes perform these rituals that he learned from A.E. Waite, the Christian magician, I guess you could call him, was one of the people with whom Williams studied ritual magic. And he learned these rituals that he would practice on these women where there was nothing overtly sexual, but nevertheless, there was a transfer of energy. He would kind of use magical means to draw energy from them, and it had to be feminine energy. As with Dionne Fortune, there's this very gendered polarity. He would draw their energy into himself and channel it for poetic inspiration. And at one point, one of the women became very, very ill for a long time, apparently because not that he did anything that we would recognize as overtly causing illness, but because he took more of her energy from her than she could spare. And some of these rituals involved, like, you know, using a ruler to deliver a light blow. I mean, never anything that would be terribly painful, but still, occult rituals involving the transfer of energy in which he was always the dominant figure and they were subordinate. And some of his letters and letters written to him have come out only in recent decades. And so people have taken another look and said, is this really so benign as his friends at the time thought? None of this was known in his lifetime. These secret fellowships were very secret indeed, and nobody told the secret. So this is material that became public long after statute of limitations expired.
I thought being an energy vampire was a modern concept, but it really does sound like that's what he was doing, harvesting the life force and energy of these women. And as you say, even if this had been known about in his life, it may not have either been taken seriously, or a light blow wouldn't necessarily be seen as something that was that big of a deal. Whereas if this was happening now, there would be huge issues around consent and the implications of this kind of behavior, and it would be incredibly big news that this was happening. You mentioned that there were issues surrounding consent in all of this as well. Do we know how that process worked? Or obviously there's some power dynamics at work here as well, but do we have any more information about how these women became involved in these rituals?
Yeah, so whenever anyone explicitly voiced non-consent, he would immediately say, okay, and he would release them and generally break off the friendship as well and not have anything more to do with them. But once he realized that someone was non-consenting, he would stop. So there's nothing there that could have been prosecuted.
I feel like that would have been a difficult thing to prosecute anyway, to stand in front of a court and say, well, this man stole my energy. I don't know how that would sit in front of a court of the time to try and justify that as having evidence it happened.
Or a court nowadays, because we have a sadly shallow and naive materialist metaphysics that dominates society. And you can't account for these things on materialist terms, because that isn't sufficient.
Exactly. How much does a soul weigh? How much of my energy has someone taken? These things are not measurable by common scientific means.
That was and still is true.
Indeed, that is the case.
So in the example you initially gave us of co-inherence, it was about thinking about what other people are going through, directing your will and energy and prayer towards taking a burden of feeling off of someone else so that they don't have to experience pain or fear, and instead you can take that on yourself. But in this case, it seems much more like harvesting of feminine energy to put towards other uses. Do we get a lot of examples of this idea of sharing energy, of taking other people's energy in this way?
Not so much that, but in the portrayal of his villains, people like Gregory Persimmons and Giles Tumulty, they have wonderful Dickensian names. He knows how magic and ritual power can be abused. He always tried to stay on the right side of that abuse, but was clearly very aware of the potential for it. And you can say the dark magicians are gaining power from other people and from magical objects in order to use for their own aggrandizement. And the distinction that he always drew was that rightly used, that power should be for the glory of God. It should be humbly surrendered to the service of whatever divine force has come in the world and made itself available. But I think it was a fine line for him. I think he struggled with it, and his church friends certainly did not know about his magical practice, although his magical friends knew that he was also a practicing Christian. I think he tried very, very hard to keep that balance. Often he did, sometimes he didn't.
And he definitely knew which of those sides should know about the other one and which one shouldn't. You mentioned that people referred to him as being saintly. Did he refer to himself as being saintly? Was it that self-aggrandizing? Did the humility tropes still exist for him?
No, he certainly was a humble man. He never made any claims for himself. He's often very self-effacing and self-critical in his letters. But W.H. Auden, for example, credits Williams with his conversion to Christianity. And I think T.S. Eliot said that when he encountered Williams, this was the only time he had ever been in the presence of personal sanctity. And I think sainthood, it's interesting, how do we decide who is a saint and who is not? I think two elements have to be present. One is what the Catholic Church calls heroic virtue, simply goodness. And the other is charisma, because there are many, many people who are extremely good people who devote their lives to works of kindness and charity and have all the virtues, but they're so unassuming, so unobtrusive, that no one would ever call them saints. On the other hand, there are many people who have charisma, and think of all kinds of artists and actors, athletes, performers, God forbid politicians as well, who are charismatic, but no more virtuous than the average, if not less so, and no one would call them saints either. But when you look at the great saints, if you look at St. Hildegard or Francis of Assisi, Catherine of Siena, we could all give long lists of our favorite saints. There are always these two things. There's virtue and there's charisma. And Williams, I think, had charisma to an extraordinary degree. And he was a good man. He tried very hard to be loving and patient and kind and humble. But what really drew people to him was this exceptional force of personality that I think is just a natural gift. And in his case, it was strengthened by intense concentration in both ritual practice and in contemplative prayer, which he engaged in, and in liturgical practice. And so he had it to an extraordinary degree. And this is what brought so many people to think of him as saintly.
So we have so many written works by him. We have all of this fiction and poetry. But when it comes to discussions of his mystical experiences, mystical practices, do we have his own reflections on those, or are we getting them through other sources, those close to him, or do we only have them as they come through in these constructions within his fictional works?
Mostly we're getting them from other people, although there are correspondences that survive, and more of his letters are being published. He was separated from his wife during World War II because the Oxford University Press moved from London to Oxford to avoid bombing, and he moved with the press. His wife didn't want to go. So during the war years, there's a long exchange of loving correspondence with his wife. But also, for many, many years before that, he was in love with another woman, whom he called Celia. He gave her a code name. It never became sexual. You know, they never had a sexual affair. She was married to someone else, as was he, but he had this intensely romantic and erotic fixation on her, and also tried to be her spiritual director, as it were. So there's what we would see now as a clear violation of boundaries. And those letters have become public quite recently. And in them, he talks about some of his spiritual practices, partly in the context of attempting to direct her. So I should also mention an aspect of his writing that we haven't talked about yet. And that is, he did write theological books. He wrote an extraordinary 1939 book called The Descent of the Dove, A History of the Holy Spirit in the Church. And it's not very long, considering that it's a history of the church from the beginning to the present day, his present day. It's maybe 250 pages. So he tells the story in short order, but he emphasizes church history as the history of the Holy Spirit in the church. And also, of course, his key theme of coherence. So that is a really remarkable book. And any church historians out there in the audience, I urge you, have a look at that. Another little book that he wrote during the war was called The Forgiveness of Sins. This is very short. It's almost like a long pamphlet, and it was commissioned by some publisher during the war years. They were doing a series of these. But it's an extraordinary meditation on what forgiveness means, because it was written in 1942, 43. This was a very dark time in the war, and it looked very much as if the Nazis were going to win. There was the Battle of Britain. I mean, many people feared that the Nazis would in fact win, and Britain or all of Europe would become the Third Reich, right? The German Empire. And in that context, he meditates on what it would mean to forgive the Germans and entertains this seriously as a duty that Christians would have to practice, even if they did succeed in conquering England. And again, that's a remarkable reflection. I mean, now we forget how close they did come to winning in the middle of those war years. But it's something that Williams thought about, and it's something he certainly discussed with T.S. Eliot when Eliot was writing Little Gidding. There is a very, very close friendship between Williams and Eliot during the war years. They were both fire marshals together, you know, patrolling the streets, watching for bombs or, you know, Luftwaffe aircraft. And you can put Williams' meditation on the forgiveness of sins together with what Eliot says in Little Gidding. The dove descending breaks the air with flame of incandescent terror, and so forth. And this dove is both the Holy Spirit and a Luftwaffe bomber. Again, I'm sure that they talked a lot as Eliot was writing that poem.
That is incredible. I mean, thinking in that moment about the potential need to forgive the Germans, and that being a Christian responsibility. I mean, I guess it goes really well with the concept of coherence and the idea that everyone is one within God. Forgiveness would be incredibly important in order to maintain those kinds of connections. Now, obviously he's writing from a Christian perspective. Do we get the sense from his work that coherence is available to all people? Is it restricted to Christians? Are there any specific obstacles that prevent people from exercising or practicing coherence?
Yeah, it is a universal. He talks about how it begins with pregnancy. Each of us begins our human life literally in the body of another. And when we emerge from the womb, if we're Christians, we proceed from the womb to the font and enter into the body of Christ through baptism. But even if one is not Christian, it's still, for him, it's the principle of all life. And it applies even to those who are enemies. In one of his poems, I forget the exact lines, but one of the characters says, "We differ from them, from the enemy, only in that we know that we are contained in them, but they do not know that they are contained in us," which means that we are also tainted by other sins. And so we can offer them up as part of the work of atonement.
You could offer up the sins of other people.
You can offer up the sins of other people. And that's part of what it means to pray for your enemies, to pray for the forgiveness of their sins, because you realize that you have part in those sins as well through the fact of coherence.
That takes the potential for Christian guilt to a whole new level of being guilty for the entirety of the world.
Yep, you got it. That's what original sin is.
Yeah, I guess we think of original sin as like, yes, and that is why you need to pray and you need to ask for forgiveness and you need to go through baptism and you need to continue taking communion and continue confessing. But the idea that it's like also everyone else's sins, pray for those too. That's also your job.
Because we are not saved individually, we are saved communally. And that's an essential part of William's insight. One of his favorite images of salvation is the city, right? Because the Bible begins with just two people in the Garden of Eden, solitary, but it ends in the city of God. And he loved the city. I mean, he loved London itself, his own city, but he just loved the image of the city as a place where there's a wonderful Anglican prayer, "Let us never forget that our common life depends on one another's toil." And that's in one of the prayers for Compline. And so much of his work embodies that insight that there is a posthumous collection of his essays that's titled The Image of the City. And it's on precisely that idea.
And you mentioned that he was a literary critic, particularly of Dante. Was he a big fan of Dante, or did he take umbrage with any of his constructions of sin, virtue, individual responsibility, or, as someone who really loves cities, the image of the city of Dis? What does he think about Dante, and how do their worlds connect?
No, he loved Dante. His most famous book on Dante, and critics still read it, is called The Figure of Beatrice. And that actually brings us to something we haven't talked about yet, which is his theology of romantic love. Because Dante saw in Beatrice, and although they were both married to other people, this is a situation that resonated with him, Dante saw in Beatrice the image of divine beauty. And for him, not just the allegory of Beatrice, but the material embodied form of Beatrice, this woman whom he loved, was God's call to him. Dante literally saw himself as having been fetched out of hell by the prayers of Beatrice. Beatrice sent Virgil to seek him when he was on the verge of being damned, to show him the way through hell and through purgatory to the earthly paradise, where he met Beatrice, who died very young, and then she escorted him through all the circles of heaven and led him to the throne of God, to the beatific vision. But the role of Beatrice in the Divine Comedy is something that Charles Williams has written about, I think, more insightfully and eloquently than virtually anyone, because he saw what he called the Beatrician way of love as a way that anyone could follow, that romantic love is meant to be a pathway to God, that in the beloved, we see divine love, we see divine beauty in that particular form that God has designed exclusively for us. And so he wrote, this was published only posthumously because no publisher would take a risk on it. But he wrote a little book called The Theology of Romantic Love, in which he outlines how to follow that way, you know, how to imitate Dante, not as a poet, but as a lover and as a mystic.
And does that involve the same kinds of concepts of coherence, or is that its own thing? And obviously, neither of these men were necessarily strictly monogamous. Is it a broader concept that is not limited to a singular person?
He struggled with that. He struggled a lot with that because when he was courting his wife, it was a very, very long courtship because they had no money and they were too poor to marry. But his wife, before they were married, was his Beatrice, and he saw himself as following that way. And it was that kind of spiritual crisis for him when, after being married, he nevertheless fell in love with another woman. And he tried to come to terms with that intellectually. He called her Celia, the heavenly one, as a code name. And he tried to define the Celian moment where one pursues that same allure of divine beauty, but under the auspices of renunciation, because no sexual consummation is possible there. And to his credit, he did not try to attain sexual consummation with her. But nevertheless, you know, there are like hundreds and hundreds of letters, a real romantic obsession. So I don't think he was able to renounce her as fully as he probably should have. I mean, she married some military man and went to Java to get away from him.
That definitely seems like emotional cheating when you have a thick stack of letters to someone who has become your potential new Beatrice when you're already married.
Yeah, Dante also was already married. And when he was exiled by the Florentines, his wife never went with him. He traveled alone. Of course, Beatrice had died. It's easier to idealize a dead beloved than a living one.
Oh, absolutely. Any mistakes they're going to make, they're already done. You can forgive them and move on. There's nothing stopping you. So as we are coming towards the end, we have the kind of final question of the podcast, which in your particular case, given that you have studied so many mystics in so many different ways and in so many different time periods, potentially other than the fact that some of the other prominent ones were already taken, what is it that you find so fascinating about Charles Williams that made you want to speak about him today?
He deserves to be a lot better known than he is. I think that C.S. Lewis has a very strong evangelical following. Tolkien has very much a fantasy Dungeons and Dragons type following. Williams is an esoteric figure, and it's remarkable that even in the age of the internet, when just about anyone can access just about anything, there's still a place for esotericism, because it's not just about difficulty of access. It's about difficulty of comprehension. There is a kind of intrinsically strange other aspect to someone like Williams. Many people do not find him, but many people might like, especially the novels, the theological books. I adore his poetry. I've managed to turn 3 people onto it in my entire life, but they also adore his poetry. Taliesin through Logris. If you love poetry and you're an Arthur fan, try it. I just want Williams to be better known than he is. And I especially think the concept of coherence should be better known.
He definitely does deserve to be better known. And now that you have preached the good word of his poetry, I'm sure that we will get some of our listeners seeking it out for themselves. So you may end up converting more than the 3 people that you have so far.
That would be nice.
Please, anyone listening, do let me know if you've picked up the poetry and what you thought of it so that I can send Barbara an update. Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today and for telling me all about Charles Williams.
Well, thank you. It's really been a pleasure. Go well, peace, under the mercy, as Charles Williams would say.
And to you, thank you so much.
And thank you all for listening. Follow us on Twitter at MyFaveMystic. You can check out the first few episodes of the podcast are now on YouTube at MyFaveMystic. And join me next month when I speak to Lee Irwin about Black Elk.